Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series.
You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Watch Hacks, streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look out. It's only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a napkin fold artist, and I love films. As Jonathan Swift once said, may you live every day of your life by listening to the Singing in the Rain soundtrack every morning. I hear you, Jonathan Swift. I mean, I think that's, you know, a lovely idea. Why it would get repetitive. Who am I kidding? It's not going to get repetitive. It's fucking amazing. Every week, I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died. Then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Barry Jenkins, Kevin Smith, Sharon Stone, and even Ked Brambles. But this week, it's the brilliant actor, writer, producer, director, artist, all-round genius, Mr. Jim Cummings. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you get an extra 20 minutes with Jim, I think. We go deep. We talk about beginnings and endings. You get a frankly insane secret from him. You also get the whole episode uncut as a video. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Ted Lasso Season 2 is now all available on Apple TV+. You can watch the whole show in one go, have a laugh and a cry. Super Bob, the film we made in 2015, is now available on Amazon Prime in the States and in the UK, so get to that. And you can watch Soulmates on Amazon Prime. So, Jim Cummings. Jim Cummings is a truly inspiring artist. I rarely use that word artist, but I think it applies to him. He's everything I want in an artist. He had a vision, he went out and he made his own shit. He's fucking amazing. He makes his own films, writes, directs, acts, produces, gets shit done. It's incredible. And they're all fucking brilliant. He's got a new film out called The Beta Test, which I saw and it's brilliant. I would recommend it. We recorded this a few weeks ago and it was a lot of fun. There's some lovely stuff in here and I think you're really going to love it. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 175 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is I, Brett Goldstein, and I'm joined today by an actor, a writer, a producer, a creator, a hero, a man who will make shit happen, a man who will not let any system or studio or any old fucking bullshit get in the way of being a true artist. He is a legend. He is an inspiration. He's also a very lovely boy. Please welcome to the show, the brilliant, it's Mr. Jim Cummings!
Thank you, Brett. I'm glad that you said he will make shit happen and not make shit, which is all of our other reviews.
He will make good shit. He will make good shit happen. I'll tell you this. Right, let's just tell... I'm very excited to see you. So let's just fucking calm
Likewise.
Down a second, shall we? It's fucking... Oi, calm down. Hang on. Listen.
He has the catchphrase. Oh, great. Cool. Let's do it.
I first heard of you because there is a brilliant comedian in England and filmmaker called Rachel Stubbings, Rachel Ann Stubbings. And she has a night that she puts on where she puts on, like, amazing work. And she put on your original short for Thunder Road, plus another short. I'm afraid I don't remember what it was called, but where a guy is being resuscitated by the pool.
It's all right. It's okay.
It's all right. It's okay. And she put them both on and she was like, this guy is the fucking shit. And they blew all of our little minds. And then I think I posted that short and I was like, you got to watch this. And then you messaged and said, I've seen you in Derek. And I said, what is going on? And then we had a cuddle
We've been married 5 years.
It's been no. So my story of that is exactly that of like, you were the first real supporter of my shorts, and I was like, this is somebody who I deeply respect in comedy because he's so good in Derek and so lovely, but also this complicated performer. It's very, very, very good. And it was like, it's one of the first like real role models in modern British television. I was like, oh, I could do that. And then you were doing stand-up at South by Southwest the year that we won for the short film of Thunder Road, and we had been pen pals.
No, you won for the feature.
That was it then.
That's when you won for the feature. That was your audience award, yeah.
Oh, it was longer than I thought. Wow. And then we were trying to meet up, and then we didn't. But then I think it was that same year, I was in a bar in Los Angeles, and yep. I saw someone that looked just like you across the bar, and I DM'd you, and I said, there's a guy that looks just like you in this bar in Los Angeles. And you were talking to someone, and then you laughed, and then looked at your phone, and then looked up like Meerkat. You're like, where is this? Is he here? And I was like, oh my God. And then we got to hang out for a minute. It was great fun.
It was really great. Now, for those of you who don't know, if anyone is listening and doesn't know, I mean, you really do have to watch all of Jim Cummings' work, because it is really phenomenal. But the thing about you, which is, you know, it's not usual. You really fucking made shit happen. You just don't give a shit. You made a short, then you made a feature. You just did it.
Yep.
And you didn't let anyone get in your way. Tell me how your brain works. Was there any point in the process, let's take Thunder Road, which is a critically acclaimed, beloved film, quite rightly so, that you made from a short in which you starred, wrote, produced, directed, everything.
Yeah.
It's a heck of an undertaking. Was there any point in the making of any side of that, the short and the feature, where you thought, what am I doing? What have I done?
At every point when you're doing it. Of course it's that. Like, if you're making an independent film, it's every day you are questioning yourself and falling into these like inadequacy traps. But I had success with the short, and I had done it because I was a producer at College Humor making sketch comedies. And none of the stuff that I was doing was that impressive as a producer, and none of it was very important. And then I thought, I'm just going to make something that I think could be good, and we'll shoot it on a Saturday. And I booked a date 2 months out, and I was like, I have to write something perfect for this thing. And that became the Thunder Road short film. It was this pettiness that had built up to become ambition in me. And then we shot it, and it did very well. It won Sundance and South by Southwest as a short in 2016. And then nobody would take us seriously because the budget was so low. I think to make the feature, it cost us $190,000 American. And so we ran a Kickstarter campaign to raise the funds to make the movie. And we did it. And it became the feature that kind of blew up and became the sensation around the world. But I suggest now everybody do it. Like, there's no difference between what we did and what you can do and what really anybody else is doing. Like, you could totally reproduce that on your own if you wanted to.
I agree. And I'm always telling people that. But I also think watching your stuff, I'm genuinely curious about it. I watch your stuff and I go, yes, you made all this yourself. You did it all yourself. It's an incredible achievement. But it's also really good. Like, I do think you have to have some talent. Like, you happen to be very, very good at acting and very good at writing and very good at directing. Like, it's not just, I don't know. I just wonder, like, how much of it was trial and error on your part and how much of it, like, did you storyboard it? Did you know exactly what you wanted? Like, how did it?
I knew exactly what I wanted. I didn't storyboard because I'm a terrible illustrator. But I shot listed and I thought about how the thing should be, especially for the feature. And then for the short, it was this Saturday that we had booked out, that we had this like funeral home for 6 hours. And I had rehearsed it, you know, 2 months in advance on my drives to work. So I had a 45-minute drive to work and a 45-minute drive home. And it was just me doing it several times and crying in traffic and having this nervous breakdown that became the film for 2 months. And it became forensic comedy. I was talking to Steve Coogan about that recently, and he was like, oh, yeah, all of Alan has to be very specific. It's like when he was coming up, it was all sketch and improv. And he was like, no, this could be a different way to do it and nail it down. And I'm not good at improv. I'm terrible at improv. But I'm decent at planning all this stuff out from seeing it from the outside lens and then making it. So really, when I'm acting, it's just this kind of self-directing. It's like, I know how it's going to look and how much I should turn so the camera can't see me. All of that kind of stuff. It's really weird. We're like in the mind while you're doing it. I'm never giving in to the experience. It's more like all of the technical stuff. But because I rehearse it so much, it looks okay. You can't tell the difference, I'm told by people.
Wow.
Yeah, really weird. But no, really, all of the process of making things and growing to where we are now has just been a necessity of like nobody taking it seriously, and then how you have to make things to get it out of your body to like tell the story that you want to tell. And I think we're not alone in that. Like most independent filmmakers are struggling to get anybody to take them seriously. And I mean, my raison d'etre is to be like, there is no difference. If you do it on your own, you'll get it done faster.
100. I mean, you know, I agree. I mean, yeah. You know, I'm into all that. Tell me this, though. Like, I've watched your new film, which is just about to come out, or has just come out?
It's come out in the UK on the 15th of October, and it's out in America on the 5th of November, Guy Fawkes Day.
It's called The Beta Test. It is fucking brilliant. I really, really loved it. It's fucking great. It's really great. It's great in all the ways that you're really great. It's really funny. It's really funny. It's got one bit in it I wanted to tell you off. I'll have to tell you off Zoom, which I'm like, that's one of the funniest moments I've seen this year. Like, it's just such a funny, original idea. There's some really funny stuff in it, but it's also very serious. It's a whole load of tones, something that you're particularly good at.
Wait, what's the funny thing? You can spoil it. There's nothing. It's okay. It's an it's out. It's an historical document. You can talk about it.
Yeah, she said it. That's the bit.
Oh my God. It's my favorite moment because we do this whole montage. So what he's talking about is there's this moment where my assistant says something to me and then I'm thinking that she said it and she says that she said something else. And then it goes into this weird like giallo style spooky montage where I'm thinking about whether or not she said it. And then we completely debase that filmmaking by having my character at the end of it go, no, she said it. And then it cuts to me confronting her again. And it's this punchline. It's my favorite moment in the film.
It's such a good gag as well, because also it's so far away. The punchline is so far away from the setup that you're like, I think we've moved on to, you feel like you're in a whole new scene. It's really funny. It's really good. Funny. But it's also like you do a thing quite especially like different, very different tones. It's very serious and it's dark. Yep. And there's also, if I may say, I was thinking about this because I keep debating sex in cinema. You see, yep. You know,
there's not much of it anymore.
It's not much of it anymore, which I think is to do with pornography. And there's always an argument of, do you need it? What's it for? And does it, blah, blah, blah. I think there is a really excellent sex scene in your film. And it's like a really good bit of storytelling. And it's really good acting. And like, it's quite, like a lot is going on.
It's a fight scene.
There's so much happening in that scene. It's really just happening in their faces and how it's fucking great. And also I imagine not easy to film.
No, it's very uncomfortable, obviously. Yeah. But because of that, because of this like generational political shift towards sanitized filmmaking, it's very difficult to get any of that shot. Where like, even in my mind, I'm an American. I'm like the most Puritan person that there is. And so I'm nervous about doing any of this stuff. Mm. But we had an intimacy coordinator for both scenes. And it was this kind of like, it was more of a kung fu scene in the practicing of it. And so both partners got to enact it as a comedy where like we both understood that sex is not supposed to be this like, it's not supposed to be pornographic, it's supposed to be hilarious. And so like in showing it, we got to lean into that stuff where really feels like a fight scene between Virginia Newcomb and me, and we were just laughing the whole time. It was great.
Oh, great. It's really good. It's great sex scene.
Okay, good.
Great sex scene. Great film. So much in it. Loved it. Anyway, and yeah, and it's also, you have that thing of, which I like, is there are arguably sort of themes in all your films, and they seem to be, the thing that connects them possibly is something to do with the death of masculinity and but they're also completely different, almost completely different genres, and they're wild. Like I love that you can't go, well, it's this film, and yeah, it's thoroughly entertaining. I mean, just brilliant. I mean,
thank you. The three movies that we made where I'm the lead actor, it's all about somebody pretending to be someone that they're not, and that facade, because that I find to be very comedic and dramatic. As soon as you break that facade, I guess that's what comedy is. You set up like a social standard and then somebody breaks it, and that's what's funny. And then the same thing happens with like dramatic punchlines as well, where it's, you know, you show somebody in the worst day of their life, or, you know, having a problem with their family and it's not funny anymore, but it's, you get to see them break that social boundary of asking somebody for help, and it's tragic. But no, I realize like that's the majority of the stuff that I do is watching somebody have a meltdown in the parking lot, because I find it to be so hilarious and endearing.
It's so fascinating that you, that, I've heard, like, I remember hearing about Russell Crowe was being interviewed about making The Nice Guys. And there's a scene in it where, you know, he kicks in the door of a toilet and Ryan Gosling's in the toilet and the door goes back and forth about 10 times. And he was like, we were forensic on it. We tried 9 times and we tried 11 times and we found that 10 times was the funniest. And I find it very interesting, that sort of forensic. Like, it sounds not fun. It's amazing. Like, as in, I can see all the, however you get there, I suppose, in it.
But no, I think it is this weird, like, psychological thing with watching video as well, of, like, watching you perform, and it's like, it seems to be very improv in these moments, and then the audience feels like a voyeur and enjoying, like, real off-the-cuff lightning in the bottle. Whereas with the stuff that I'm doing, I'm trying to recreate what you're doing, of, like, I have all of this construct of the camera movement, long takes, and then I try to reproduce authenticity, and it's incredibly difficult. I'm very bad at it, but most people can't tell, it seems.
It's so amazing. But you're crying. I mean, when you're crying, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So how's that happening?
I have a list. I'm really bad, dude. This is such a confession. Nobody's asked me. I have a notes memo on my iPhone of all the things that make me cry, and I, like, chart them anytime I'm watching a movie, and I'll write it down. And then when I need to cry for a scene, I'll bring up the iPhone and then I'll, like, read these things that make me cry. And it's pathetic, of, like, Inside Out. Is that how you do it? I mean, like, I don't know any other way.
No. I'm just fascinated. I'm absolutely fascinated how anyone does it.
There's one photograph of Prince William and Prince Harry at their mother's funeral, and Prince Charles, and he looks dumbfounded and confused and lost. And it's Prince William looking down at Prince Harry, and he's obviously a bit older, and he's looking down, and the photograph tells the story of, like, my dad's an idiot. I'm going to have to raise this kid. And it's this heartbreaking photograph, and I pull it up all the time. And that's the thing that helps me to cry. It's so sad. And then, like, I have these anecdotes of, like, every flower shop in England gave their flowers away for free for the funeral. Like, all of these things like that, that I know will mess with me when I read them on set, and then it helps me to perform.
Amazing. And then and when you're directing as well. Oh yeah, that's what I want to ask you. That's the thing I never fully get about if you are an actor director, is do you watch back every take on the monitor, or do you, like, how does it work?
No. So for the Thunder Road short, we did 6 full takes, and the 6th one, I was like, I think we got it. And then we watched that one. And then for the Thunder Road feature, we did 18 takes, and we watched the 18th one, and I was like, I think we got it. I think that was it. But legitimately, if you're acting in the thing and directing it, there are moments where you're feeling it and you go, nah, I can do it better. And there are moments where you'll say that 7 minutes into a 13-minute long take and say, no, we got to do it again. It was like the last take that we did was better than this one, so I know I won't use this one. We can scrap it and then move on to the next one. So it's really just a practical answer of, like, yeah, that's not going to work.
Amazing. And so
it's not. Like, that's not something you learn in acting school. Like, I didn't go there, and so because I didn't, this is just the best way that I know how to do it.
But what you're describing, and I get, you know what, I think I can relate it more to stand-up, which is in stand-up, it's something that, like, sure, Steve Martin talks about in his book, amazing book, Born Standing Up, where he talks about kind of, I can't remember his exact word for it, but how your brain is in two places at once. You're in the moment, you're present, and you're reacting to the audience laughter, but your brain is also 10 steps ahead going, okay, so now I need to do this. They're yep. reacting to this, so I need to do this. And you yep. are equally present and equally and standing back and analyzing everything. Your brain is just doing both at once. And that's you acting on film that you're directing?
So yes, it's that living in the moment of, like, trying to make it seem authentic, but then also trying to live up to the script and the podcast. So, dude, when we do a screenplay, I'll record it like this in this very microphone as a podcast, and we'll do it. I'll play all the parts and I'll put in music and sound design so that anybody that shows up on set can hear the movie a couple times before they show up. And it just becomes us trying to enact that and raise the ceiling of that podcast version of it. But it's a really effective way to make sure that the comedy and the drama and the horror is working. And I feel like that's the only reason we know, like, most filmmakers when they show up on set have never heard it come out of human vocal cords before. And so they don't know if it's going to work before rehearsal. That's, like, the one litmus test that we have before shooting. That's really, really helpful. And so we already, like Hitchcock, apparently, when he was on set, would be very bored and would eat the whole time because he was like, the movie's already done in my head. We just have to shoot the thing. And I find that to be so honest in a weird way with my kind of filmmaking, where it's like we just have to elevate the podcast version of it, and the actors are given that, and they have to make it better. And we kind of all speak the same language of the film before we show up.
I've never heard that. I've never heard that done that way. That's really, really interesting. And you know what? It really works. It clearly really, really works because it also doesn't, the films never look like that. They never feel.
No, thank you.
They never feel machine tooled to within an inch of their lives. You know what I mean? They feel alive, and that's fascinating.
Every scene of Parasite was storyboarded, and like every movement of the camera was part of the DNA of that thing. And Bong Joon-ho is like a huge hero of mine. David Fincher is the same way. Of like everything is done before they show up, and they just have to make it work. I don't think it's a very fun experience for actors to live in that space, but I love working with actors and then having them come up with better stuff than I ever could have imagined with the movie. Right. It's so freeing.
Incredible.
It's not.
It's incredible.
It's tactical. Tactical, yeah.
Last question, we'll wrap this up. No, last question. Do you know what starts the next project for you? As in, is it one idea? Is it a scene? Is it, you know, what is the thing that makes you go, that's what I'm doing next?
With my second movie, The Wolf of Snow Hollow, I was watching True Detective Season 1, and they kept on referring to the bad guy as the tall man. And then when you meet him, he's not that tall. And I was like, he's fine. He's a great actor. No, it's fine. It's great.
That's a real wasted opportunity.
Exactly. It's one of my favorite TV shows of all time. One of my favorite seasons of television of all time. Mm-hmm. And then he's not that tall. And then I was like, that'd be so cool to have the bad guy be referred to as this tall guy. And then at the end of the film, you just see him stand up and it's like, yep, that's the bad guy. I just thought that was like such an interesting biological reveal. Like a Hitchcockian reveal. And so that was the thing where I was like, that could be really cool. And I worked backwards from there. But then with our new stuff, it's just the stuff that makes us actually laugh and actually cry. The things that we know that we specifically could do, knock out the park of like, oh, I could tell that story. I wouldn't be good at this one. And we have 1,000 ideas for movies, but like the ones that really end up getting filmed are the ones that we know we love, like truly affect us biologically. Of like, I always say, if you have to ask if you're having a heart attack, you're not having a heart attack. And it's true. It's like, you know it when it hits you and you have to call 911. And that's kind of us racing to screenplay format to make the thing.
Jim Cummings, I should have said this before we started. Oh, fuck. Oh, I feel like an idiot, actually. I should have opened with this and then we could have had it with a nice chat. But I'll just say it. You've died. You're dead. Okay?
You're kidding me.
No. Dead. Dead. You're dead.
This is it.
How did you die?
Probably the drink.
Really? The drink. The drink got you. How old were you?
It sounds like I was born in 1860, if I'm calling it the drink. I'm 35 years old and I died.
You died at 35.
I'm so used to this thing, man. Like, I'm so used to thinking that I'm dying tomorrow.
Oh, really? Tell me about that. Hang on. You literally drank yourself to death on purpose, by accident, at 35.
Certainly by accident. I got too excited watching like a Paolo Sorrentino film and I fell down a flight of stairs drunk. Certainly. Okay. That's it. Yeah.
Okay. So let's be clear on this. You've died falling down a flight of stairs. Let's not blame poor the drink. The drink was blameless. I blame the stairs. So you fell down the stairs. You were very excited.
They were equally to blame. Yeah, I was very excited. I was raving about this movie, talking to myself about the future of cinema, and fell down the stairs. And
instant death, neck break.
Oof. I think so.
Jesus, I'm so sorry. Do you worry about death?
I don't, because I was dead for a long time before I was born, for millions and billions of years before I was born. So I think I'll be okay.
What do you think happens after you die?
I think the people that loved you will feel very sad. Do you have a better answer?
Yeah.
Unless I'm wrong. Tell me everything.
Oh, there's a lot. You genuinely, I mean, I'm not like, I'm impressed. I'm not sort of, I'm not making fun of you when I say this. Like, you're genuinely like at peace with the idea of, well, there was nothing before, there'll be nothing after. It doesn't, like, you're genuinely at peace with it.
I'm very frightened by the process of not being able to breathe, or with the last year, it's been horrifying to hear stories of having to talk to your family through an iPad, and that graphic, violent death is not theft, is not lost on me. But no, I don't. I try not to think about it because I have such trouble engaging with life. Like, I watch these Ghibli movies and I'll put on like long YouTube videos of Ghibli music and that kind of life pornography I forget to enjoy. And so because of that and me chasing that, I try not to think about death too much, even though I know it's right behind me.
It's right in front of you now, son.
Do you? Are you stressed by it?
Sometimes. I definitely have that feeling of running out of time.
My buddy Dan told me that he said there was a moment he had a panic attack in a parking lot. I was walking with him and we went to go pick up some light bulbs from a grocery store. And he walked out into the parking lot and he was talking about death. And he said, I feel like I'm walking out into the ocean and the shore keeps getting farther away. And I keep thinking, oh, I'm getting pretty deep out here. And at that moment, he dropped the light bulb packet and they all broke. And he was like, he had to go down on his knees and he was like, I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know what's happening. And then I had to like get him into the car. It was very terrifying, but it was laughable for me. You know, as a non-believer, I was like, oh no, you got nothing to worry about, kid. It's fine. But it's terrible to see someone really stress out about the thing. And it's not from lack of understanding it. Like, I feel like I spent my entire youth being thoughtful of mortality and, you know, thinking about Christopher Hitchens on his deathbed and esophageal cancer and like actually understanding the thing. But then, you know, pancakes are so wonderful and there's so much to life that you can love, you know?
Yeah. I'm sure I've said this before, but it's why I like can't abide small talk. I cannot abide it because I'm like, we're all going to fucking die.
I've noticed that. I've seen some of your interviews and it's really funny to watch someone ask you about your work and you're like, I don't know. Yeah, I did that thing. It was one day of work. What do you want me to say? It's really funny.
We're all going to die. That's why
do you
I
not
always
understand,
want to answer.
Yeah. So you're living constantly in the seventh seal and you're this fucking crusade.
You just want content, but we're all going to die. You think this will fill a day? Sure. Anyway, look, good news. Good news, actually. There's a heaven. Surprise. Surprise. And it's...
That is a surprise.
I know. And it's really nice, actually. It's filled with your favorite thing. What's your favorite thing?
Alfonso Cuarón movies.
It is wall-to-wall Cuarón. Like, just every wall.
You can't move for the stuff. It's everywhere. Yeah.
You can't move for Alfonso. He's everywhere. All his stuff. And he's knocking about, answering any question you have about any of his stuff. He's very open to it. Anyway, everyone's very excited to see you. They really are. They're huge fans. And they want to hear about your life, but they want to hear about your life through film, because that's what they're like. And the first question they ask you is, what's the first film you remember seeing, Jim Cummings?
I remember my babysitter taking me to see 101 Dalmatians in the theater. And I loved it, obviously. It's so well, it's so funny and so well made and so beautiful. And the music is wonderful. And that's the first movie where I remember thinking that was really cool. I'd love to make something like that. Or like, that's an entire world, a universe where you could create whatever you wanted to. And it didn't have to be filmed. It could be entirely animated. I remember watching that as a six-year-old or whatever and going, yeah, that was pretty cool.
Where was this? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Metairie, Louisiana, which is like 15 minutes outside of New Orleans. And it would have been the Canal Place Cinema in, you know, 1991, probably.
Love it. You told me before we started, if I may, how many siblings are you? How many are you?
I have five sisters and two brothers. So there's eight of us together. I'm second to last. Too many.
Same parent?
Same parents. But the old joke, the old Hal Roach joke was we had to put my mom up on a pedestal just to keep her away from my dad. Too much sex.
That's outrageous. Hey, that's outrageous. I mean, that's fucking mad. all due
too
respect.
Many.
That's too many. Listen, that's too many people to have like dinner with, let alone every night.
Especially every night, you get so bored. It's a bunch of Mormons basically at that point. It's brutal.
One of eight, and you're number seven. Lucky number seven.
I'm seven. Yeah.
So when you were, I mean, how? Here's my problem with more than three kids. Very difficult to go to Disney World.
You can't keep track of them.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. You got to keep some on leashes, the younger ones, and then the older ones have to keep the other ones on leashes, and then you just look.
You're
mad
just a train
running.
You're
around.
A train,
and you can't train at that point, yeah. And you can't enjoy anything. I don't think, and it's so weird to go. So we used to go to Europe. We used to go to Italy. And it was 19 of us with the extended families. Fuck. We have to go to the fucking Vatican with 19 Jesus. People to enjoy the Sistine Chapel. And you're like, yeah, it's great. But we got to find a table for 19 for lunch because we're all starving. It's awful.
At least at the Vatican, the Pope's going, good, good. They definitely don't use contraception. Okay, good.
Oh, big, full blessing at that point.
Big respect. Yeah, yeah.
You get the double Pope you hands double for that one.
You are welcome anytime. Eight kids. And I mean, it's no wonder you ended up performing a bit, is it?
It's weird because my older brother, my brother John, is 2 years older than me, and he was always the consummate performer and still is. And he's a lawyer for the CIA. So he's like not a...
What?
So he like should have gone to SNL, but then did the legal work. Wow. I'm sure he's listening right now. But I was always the observer of the rest of my siblings.
Of course he's listening. The CIA are always listening. He's picked this up live. This isn't even on the replay. He's hearing
like, hey, my boss told me I should listen to this podcast.
hey, my phone's just going. Hold on. No, yeah, we didn't say CIA. We didn't say CIA. He said CAA. He was talking about agency. Okay, bye-bye.
But he was always the performer, and I got to watch him be a comedian in high school and at the dinner table. And so I was always taking notes in a funny way. I was never the comedian. And then because I had such great surroundings as comics, I felt like I was the student of human behavior. And then that kind of made me a writer. But then I stole all of that to then, I guess, perform it, to pretend to be those types of people. I'm an introvert in real life, but then I pretend to be this extrovert in the films.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series. You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with Hacks writer and actor Pat Regan, on how their improv experience helped them when shooting scenes and what it was like writing scripts for specific actors.
You'll also hear from crew members like the costume designers on what it was like creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Hear stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and more. Watch Hacks streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Incredible. What's the film that scared you the most? Do you like being scared? Do you get scared?
Oh, man. This is so bad. I saw The Conjuring 2, the James Wan film.
It's a fucking great film.
It's unbelievable. I'm so glad to hear you say that. Every time I say that, people are like, really? I mean, come on. Really?
It's
a sequel?
Good stuff.
It's unbelievable. And I was in the cinema, and I'm a huge fan of James Wan. I have all of these, like, drunken DMs to him in the middle of the night being like, I'm such a supporter of yours, it's embarrassing. But I love that filmmaker so much. And we went to go and see it in Los Angeles, and I took my girlfriend with me, and we go in, it's probably 4 p.m., and the movie starts, it's about 10 minutes in, and I said, I think we have to leave. And I was like, this is too frightening. I hate this experience. We need to leave the movie theater. And then she was like, give it another 10 minutes. We'll wait 10 more minutes. And then she just kept me saying that all the whole movie of just like 10 more minutes, 10 more minutes. And the whole time I'm freaking out watching this thing. And the movie ends in such a beautiful way where it is this couple, Ed and Lorraine Warren, and they're dancing, listening to Elvis. And they finally put on the Elvis song. They've been talking about the whole movie. And the whole time I'm terrified that something's going to jump out and get them. But it's this fusion of romance and horror And I've never seen that before done so well. He is such a master. And I was really floored by that experience. That's the scariest movie I've ever been to.
It's a great, it is a fucking great Ghost Train, that film. Like, it really does its job extremely well. And I think it's underrated. I'm sure I've talked about it once on here before, but it's underrated in terms of, like, because it's a sequel and because it's The Conjuring and it's kind of mainstream, you go like, it's the best version of that type of film. It's so well done. Fuck, it's scary. Yeah. Great. Great shout. So you don't generally like horror, but you made one.
Yeah.
You made one, you cheeky boy.
What's wrong with you? I did. I made two, basically. Yeah. The Wolf of Snow Hollow is a werewolf film that I don't think has come out in the UK yet, but... it was basically me trying to pretend to do Zodiac as a comedy, where it's like a detective story with laughs. And then this one's very frightening. The opening is very, very frightening. And throughout the film, it's a bit scary. But no, I love horror. I guess they function a bit like comedy, where it's set up and payoff. There's like set up and then a punchline. It just happens to be a scare rather than a joke or like, you know, something to make you cry. I'm not surprised Jordan Peele has had such a great career in horror because they line up so well.
Agreed. What about crying? What's the film that made you cry the most, Jim Cummings?
No question. Inside Out. No question. I can't talk about it without crying. There's a moment in the film, I think I can talk about it, it's okay, spoiler alert, in the Pixar film Inside Out, where they're trying to get out of the situation and they have to use this magical wagon to fly out. And
Jesus.
Dude, it's fucking brutal.
Don't even talk about it.
It's a suicide in a Disney film.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's self-sacrifice. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And I'm watching it in a movie theater. And the whole time, the whole 45 minutes leading up to that is teaching the audience how they think and the emotions in their brain. And then Bing Bong jumps off the back of the wagon and kills himself so that Joy can fly up and make it. And then he says, hey, fly her to the moon for me. And then he disappears. He dies in this crazy moment. And I'm crying in the movie theater, and the music is blaring, and it's beautiful. And then I'm also thinking about why I'm crying, because the movie has taught me this media literacy lesson while watching it. It is an unbelievable gift that Pixar has given to young people to help them organize their brain. And I've never seen anything like that. I've never seen it since. It's unbelievable.
I stand by. I think it was the greatest film of the last decade. I think it's truly incredible piece of work. Like, it doesn't... But that Bing Bong thing, look, it's probably the most heroic death in all of film, because not only does he make a sacrifice, but the sacrifice he makes will never be remembered. So it's such a sacrifice.
And he lies to her. And he says, hey, I got a good feeling about this one. And then they get on the wagon and he goes, sing louder. And then jumps off. And it's like, and then the music swells. And it's like, fuck you, Pete Doctor, you fucker. Like, and now I'm crying in a theater full of people and I'm humiliated. And it's...
But I guess it's a paradox, because Bing Bong is killing himself. So and she'll never remember. But we'll never forget.
And that's what's so great. So you just made the joke that they make in the film, where at the end of the thing, Joy makes it up to the top, and it's this brutal experience. The filmmakers know that the audience is crying, and Joy goes, goodbye, Bing Bong, and it's the dumbest name of all time. And the audience goes back to laughing, and then we go on with the rest of the movie. And it's like a complete cleanse of that horrible sadness, such as life.
Oh, boy. Great shout. Great shout. What's the film? People don't really like it. It's definitely not critically acclaimed, but you love it unconditionally and you think everyone else is a dum-dum.
So you reached out, you sent me that question, and I had written The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, because I had watched half of it. And I was like, you know what? People are talking shit about this movie and they shouldn't be. And then I watched the second half and I was like, yep, nope, I understand why people don't like this film. So I have to redact it from my list.
Okay.
The film that I think gets the worst reviews, that is actually one of the best films of all time, is The Beach, the Danny Boyle film with Leonardo DiCaprio.
What an interesting shout. Interesting.
It has like a 21% on Rotten Tomatoes. It was panned when it came out because Homeboy had just done Titanic, and all the 16-year-old girls that saw Titanic and fell in love with it. I love Titanic as well, but they were expecting something different. And The Beach is such an iconic well-made narrative about that type of dude at that age, and the soundtrack is amazing, and the cinematography is amazing, the story, visual storytelling is amazing, and you just get to watch this guy grow up a bit and not be an asshole in this beautiful setting. He falls in love with this French girl. It feels like the kind of aspirational life that I wish I had at that age, you know? And I saw it when I was about 16 or 15, and it really became this anthem for me of what life could be. And I think that movie is so underrated.
Yeah, I think that's a really good shout. I also think about that film because that was, Danny Boyle had made three films all with Ewan McGregor, and I believe the legend is he and Ewan McGregor fell out because Ewan McGregor was going to be in The Beach, or assumed he was going to be in The Beach, and then he recast Leonardo DiCaprio. And I wonder about people's lives, as in, at what point can you move on? Did he owe it to him? I don't know. Life's complicated.
Isn't that so terrible that even after being Obi-Wan Kenobi, even after getting put into those things, you still wonder what your life could be because of these inadequacy traps that you set up in your mind as a performer, where you're like, oh, maybe my life could have been so much better if I'd done this thing. But the movie flopped, kind of. The movie wasn't well received. So what do you do?
What's the film that you used to love, you loved it, and then you've watched it recently, and for whatever reason that is your own, you don't like it anymore? Jim Cummings.
Yeah, I watched Mission Impossible 2, which was go-to.
Love it.
Which was a go-to for me in high school. Yeah. And I remember watching this early John Woo stuff and be like, this is the height of cinema. This is slow-mo doves flying. This is it. This is romance. And then I reached the age of reason, it seems, and watched it again. And I was like, this guy is so cheesy. Like Tom Cruise is just so cheesy in this movie.
Question. What happens? I think about this a lot. You know the song Careless Whisper by George Michael? Do you know that song?
Is that the ba-na-na-na?
Yeah.
No. Okay, that cool.
Song. Yeah, you do know it. So that song, since it came out for about, I don't know how many years, 15 years, 20 years, every year in England they do the Hall of Fame where people would vote on their favourite song. And I'd say for 20 years, Careless Whisper was number one. And then one day, all of a sudden, Careless Whisper wasn't cool anymore. The sound of someone playing the saxophone was suddenly cheesy.
Suddenly
cheesy.
Yeah.
But it used to be, the day before, it was the coolest thing ever. And I feel the same way about John Woo and slow-mo doves and all that. It was very cool. And then suddenly it was very not cool. What happened?
I think it's one of those things where it's like this uncanny valley where someone makes fun of it a whole bunch or tries to reproduce it in music videos. And then it becomes the mainstream rather than this iconic, style of Chinese cinema. And then because of that, the guy can't do it anymore. And it's quite sad where it's like when you go back and watch some of these earlier films, Hard Boiled, they do that same stuff. It's like Hard Boiled is dope. You know, there's so many old films of his that use the same style and it works. But when you watch Tom Cruise in it, it does change things. I don't know. Maybe we got older. Maybe it was never cool. And I was just 14 when I saw it for the first time and thought it was dope. But I don't know. I think it is this kind of media literacy. We got to a certain point with media literacy where it's like, oh, I know how to do that. That looks cheesy now. What's not cheesy? I guess we're all kind of chasing authenticity and cinematography matters in that sense. I don't know. I guess that's just evolution. That's just the evolution of audiences. We get more media literate. Those same tricks don't work on us before.
I do think, I think in all those cases, it becomes a thing of it's kind of been used so much by other people that it feels like a parody of itself, perhaps. But when the original person goes back to doing it. Anyway, Jim Cummings, what is the film that means the most to you? Not necessarily because the film itself is any good, but because of the experience you had around seeing the film that will always make it special.
I saw this film called Krisha at South by Southwest 2015. I was a producer at the time and I hadn't done anything. Krisha. It is unbelievable. And it was shot for $35,000 in the director's house, in his mom's house, Trey Edward Schultz. And I saw, he made It Comes at Night and Waves. He's amazing.
Waves.
He's amazing. Incredible. This is his first formalized feature. He had shot it once as a feature and it failed, and he turned it into a short film, no joke, and then got the financing based on an award that he'd won to do it as a feature again, and that became the Krisha feature film that we all know today. But I saw it in a theater at South By in 2015, and it was shot for nothing. It had great actors, and it was funny and tragic about something very important. And I left the theater. It was at noon, and I sprinted down Congress Street in a suit to get there and got in. And I was friends with the team already, but I spent the next 2 hours crying and calling family members while walking around the river in Austin, just because I was so blown away by the film. And that was in March of 2015. And by October, I was shooting the Thunder Road short film. It inspired me more than anything to get off the couch and that anybody could do this stuff.
That's really great. Also, of course, it took you 2 hours to call your family. There's fucking eight of them. That was only spending 5 minutes with each.
And you did the math. Yeah, it's a solid joke. It's a good joke. I walked right into it.
That's lovely. That you've spoken to him about that, right? That he changed your life.
No question. And then I became an associate producer because they didn't like the sound mix on it, and I was like, anything you need, like I'm happy to do. And so I knew the guys at Skywalker Sound, and so we drove up from L.A. to Northern California to go and mix the film with Michael Semanek in the next like 3 weeks because I knew the movie had to be perfect. And then it hadn't been bought yet. And so during that time, we were trying to send it to different people. And then A24 bought it with, like, I guess, a three-picture deal for Trey. So it was like this huge moment for him. And I was like, fuck, all it takes is making movies in your backyard, literally casting your mom and your aunt and yourself as the lead part. Yeah. And, you know, I could do that. I felt like watching David Fincher and Steven Spielberg in these behind-the-scenes videos, it was just like, I could never do that. Those movies look too big. Mm. But then, like, seeing Trey do it, I was like, oh, I could definitely be that guy, you know?
Love that. Love it. What's the film that you most relate to, Jim Cummings?
I mean, Children of Men is like the movie that I saw in theaters a bunch. And I was like, this is the guy. Like, Clive Owen's character in that film, Theo, is such a nice guy. And it's so, and he's also drunk, but he's also like this like heartbreaking figure where he lost this child. And then when this child comes into his life, he'll do anything to protect it as this love letter to his son. And it's so brutal and beautiful and had me laughing and crying and just in awe with the cinematography. I think, like, if there was one film to put on my headstone, even though it's not mine, it'd be that one. I'm sure I'm not alone.
Fucking good.
It's fucking unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Okay. You can have that.
You approved.
You can have that for sure. Jim Cumming, what's the sexiest film you've ever seen?
Fuck, man. That's a personal question.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's something that's the screen in theaters. You got to clarify that. Sexiest film I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
I think Uncut Gems is up there. I mean, the Julia Fox is so beautiful.
Yes.
That's a big one. Those scenes are so perverted and so much fun to watch. Recently, that would be the big one. But then, Match Point. Yeah, Match Point. Although it ends in a couple brutal murders.
Scarlett Johansson in the rain.
Yeah, that stuff. Mm. And also, like, the way that the natural progression of flirtation then leads to this affair is so authentic and beautiful, I would say, and terrifying. I would say that movie is probably the sexiest because she's such a tease and it's so aspirational. It's like, oh, of course I want to sleep with this woman. And then you realize why you shouldn't, and she's a nightmare to be around. And I think that kind of seduction and temptation is just so perfectly done.
Bit of that in the beta test. Riddle me this. There's a subcategory to this question. Troubling boners, worrying why-dons. What's a film you found arousing that you weren't sure you should?
I saw this movie called The Lure on the Criterion Channel, and it's about mermaids. You know this one?
About mermaids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a musical about mermaids, and I watched it recently, and you have that feeling of like, wow, she's really hot. Oh, no, she's half of a fish. and they show the like fish vagina, and it's really gross. And you're like, no, that's not right. But also, unless I don't know, maybe it's like it's very confusing. It's a very confusing film. That's what I would say was like half spookiness and then half boner time.
Mm. I guess it's the eternal question.
My fiance is doing laundry in the room, and she just looked at me like, "What is this film? What are you talking about?"
It's the eternal question. If you had to have sex with a mermaid and you could have the top half as a woman or the bottom half as a woman, but the top half is a fish.
Obviously, you go with the top half. Obviously, you go with the top half because yeah. Otherwise you're stuck with conversation. You're going to spend the rest of your life with this person. The conversation better be good.
Well, I'm just talking about you're having a fling. The mermaid's been very clear that she doesn't want anything more than one night.
Then the bottom half.
The mermaid's in town for like a conference, and then she's going to be leaving, and she's like, listen, no strings.
You're staying in a hotel. She's at the bar, and she makes eyes at you before you get in the elevator, and you've got your groceries, and then you think, I don't know.
And she says, top half or bottom half, which half?
I can do both. Human. But it has to be the same all night. I think at that point I'd have to say bottom half. I'm so sorry.
You want the bottom half as a woman. So you've got like a cod
and then,
head.
And then you have to hold hands or legs with the fish in the elevator. Yeah. No, that'd be brutal. Never mind. I changed my answer. It has to be top half.
Yeah, it's too late. You've got a top half fish. No, you made your decision. She was happy with it. She was flattered because
no
one ever chooses
if
that.
If she's with me, she'd definitely be happy with it. Yeah, no question.
Yeah. Okay, that's a lovely story. objectively, what's the greatest film ever made? Might not be your favorite, but it's the greatest work in cinema.
That's a really tough one. Because the difficult things is that like sometimes filmmakers will make something that's incredibly well crafted that's very small and doesn't encompass all of humanity. So I'm thinking about like what you would print on the gold disc before you sent it out into space to document humanity. Like that's the one film.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say it, like Children of Men is so good with that.
Yeah.
Of like it's so broad. It's like women and men stories incorporated, and it's about life and pregnancy and the preservation of life, which is such a human, you know, story. I don't know. I think it had to be that. But then also like Citizen Kane is so great about ambition and failing and male ego, but then that doesn't really apply to half of humanity really. I don't know. I think I'd have to say Children of Men.
Okay, you can have Children of Men. It's really something. You can have it.
Okay.
Great. You can have that. What's the film that you could or have watched the most over and over again?
I have the actual answer. Okay. The actual answer is Home Alone. Because I used to watch it as a kid, and instead of calling him Kevin, I used to call him Home Alone. So I would scream, get him, Home Alone, and my mom would make fun of me for it, even as an adult.
Surely, as a child of eight, Home Alone is a real aspirational.
It's the best. You get to beat up the bad guys, and you're smarter than your parents, and they've wronged you somehow. It's great.
You get some fucking space. Oh, Jesus.
It's all
everyone's got away.
It's all I wanted. As like all these kids, I just wanted to have the house to myself. But then there was a time in high school where I watched Fight Club countless times, and then The Royal Tenenbaums countless times. And then I think The Last Crusade is probably the movie that I would answer of like a movie that you've watched enough times to know every line and every moment. Right?
I fucking love The Last Crusade. I love it.
It is unbelievable.
I love it.
And to think that's like
a film that makes me cry.
Oh my God. He goes off the cliff in a tank and his dad has to watch him go off and then realize that he's lost his son. And then he climbs up behind them and it's a joke. Of like, yeah, no, I made it. And then we're all looking over at this tank. It's so funny. It's beautiful.
It's really funny. The final bit where he's reaching, let it go. Let it go, Indiana.
It's great.
Shit.
It's great. Good. It's so sad.
Yeah. Okay. We don't like to be negative, Jim Cummings. Everyone is doing their best. So I hope this isn't just because you think it's bad. What's the worst film you ever saw?
I mean, it's bad. There's a plethora these days. the politically incorrect version of myself would want to answer a much more modern film, but I won't. And instead, I saw a film recently that was on the Arrow Video Channel, which I suggest everybody get. It is an unbelievable gift that they've given us. But you have, I think it's $4 a month, and you can watch all of these like Sartana and Django movies and like all of these crazy giallo films from the 1960s and 70s. All this stuff I would never have seen, but they have restored, and it's an incredible service. Having said that, there's a film on the platform called The Baby from the 1970s. Okay. And you start watching it, and you're like, okay, this is this psychological thriller shot the same style in America. I think Italian directors and team. And I had to turn it off. And then I skimmed through it, and I was like, yep, that's kind of where I thought it was going. And I watched it again recently, and I don't know how it got made. Or rather, like, how the team didn't revolt in making the film of, like, this is not good. This is not going to be a good film. So that would be my answer, The Baby. I think it's 73.
Baby. Is it about a killer baby?
It's not. It's about a woman. I won't spoil it, but it's about a guy in a diaper and this woman who's taking care of him. And it's very bad.
Okay. 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 Oh, maybe I'll miss it.
Miss it if
What's
you can.
What's the... you're in comedy. You're very funny. What's the film that made you laugh the most, Jim Cummings?
The Alan Partridge feature Alpha Papa. The feature film
it's
of it.
It's fucking great.
It's unbelievable.
It's great.
It is unbelievable. And I show it to people who aren't familiar with Steve or Alan, and it works totally, where it's like it's complete introduction to the guy in his 50s, you know, 60s, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And it's a belly laugh every minute. There's like, and the way that the comedy works is that it's such a specific character, and you get to see how his cogs and his brain are working, and that's the comedy. And as soon as you learn that language, it's like the height of comedy to me, of watching somebody lie and try to keep things together. It's so much fun to watch. And I that's the movie. I cannot tell you how many times I've laughed watching that.
There's a bit in it as well that is like in one line, incredibly moving and tells you everything. And I can never fully remember it word for word, but like the Darren Boyd, who's the policeman, like holds him down and he says, yeah, do you remember?
Yeah.
What does he say to him?
He goes, they're joking about it. And he's like, pulled the gun on him. And he goes, any last words? And he goes, tell my kids I love them. Or, yeah, you know, they don't call me. So I guess yeah, it's fine. It's like this super sad moment.
It's like, so sad.
Oh, my God.
I'd probably just tell my kids I love them.
But, he goes, why don't you call me? No, actually, I should just tell them. Yeah, just tell them I love them. It's a very sad moment. But there's a joke in it that I've never heard so well in the word economy of comedy, where it's like how few letters and words you can put into a joke to make it work. And it's a moment when the guy who Pat Farrell kidnaps everybody in the studio, he's holding everybody hostage, and he goes, this is my wife, and he holds up a picture of his wife, and he goes, that was 3 months before the angels carried her to heaven. And sidekick Simon goes, there must have been a couple of them. And he hands it off. And you never see what's in the photograph, but it's clearly a fat joke. And it's so brilliant. And it's like, you don't need to see the photograph. He tells that whole story. There must have been a couple of angels. It's so funny. It's so ugly.
That's great. Well, Jim Cummings, you have been wonderful. It's completely as expected. However, if I may, when you were 35 years old, you had what you called a little too much pleasure with the drink, and you were watching the Paolo Sorrentino film Life. You were watching Life, the underrated Life. Is that what it's called? Life.
Youth.
Youth. You were watching the underrated Youth, and you were like, "This. Why has this been underrated? This film is fucking great. I am loving this." And you had a glass of port in your hand because you're like Henry VIII, and you ran around the house looking for your fiance. You're like, you've got to see this film. It's so good. It's so fucking good. You scream, and she says, I'll be up in a minute. And you go, no, come up here now. I'm going to drag you up. And you at the top of the stairs, and you tripped, and you went bish, bash, bosh, broke your neck, dead at the bottom of the stairs, which you weren't even bothered about because you're not scared of death and you think it's nothing. I'm walking by with a coffin. You know what I'm like. I knock. I'm just like, oh, I'd like to check in on Jim, tell him I enjoyed his film. I answer the door. Your fiance's in a right state. I'm like, what's the matter, babe? She goes, don't call me babe. We've never met. I go, I'm so sorry. I was being too casual. That was like a joke, but I realized we've never met. So I realized actually the whole she goes, of that were really
honestly,
wrong.
Honestly, big fan. My husband just died. So what are you up to?
I said, look, I'm just looking for Jim. She goes, Jim's just fallen down the stairs. I go, it wasn't the drink, was it? She said, yeah, you've heard. Okay, fucking hell. Come down the stairs. You're a state. Your legs are over your head. Your hands are behind your back. It's impressive, but a mess. And I do what I can. I pick the bits of you I can get up. I have to crack off bits of you because you're in such a state. Just like pull bits off like a chicken leg. Put you in the coffin. Your fiance helps me. I say, don't worry. You're probably in shock. Go and sit down. Watch the rest of Youth. And she goes, he did say it was good. I say, yeah, it's actually really underrated. Go and enjoy yourself. She pops upstairs. I put you in the coffin. I had misjudged the size of you. You're taller than you look on screen. And it's a smaller coffin. I thought, I put all the bits in the coffin, but it's jammed in there. It is jammed. Jammed packed. And I mean, there's no room in it. There's only enough room for me to slip one DVD into the side of the coffin with you for you to take across to the other side. And on the other side, it's movie night every night. What film are you showing everyone when it's your turn on the other side? Jim Cummings, go.
The temptation to say Children of Men again, but I'm not going to. The answer would be Being There by Hal Ashby.
Delightful.
Okay, good. I think that film says a lot about humanity and is about somebody pretending to be bigger than they are, and that's how we all feel together. And I love that film so much.
It's really great, that film. And also, he's whatever people project on him.
Yep.
He's nothing.
Unbelievable what they're able to do with that film, yeah. Where everybody can love that film. And he's a specific kind of goofy, I understand, like funny Peter Sellers, but still, it's so humanizing. It's still so much of our personalities of watching someone succeed. And that's how we all feel. I was in Deauville and I talked to Michael Shannon about it. And he was like, everybody says that I'm a great actor. And I look at these films that I've been in, these clips of me in movies, and I don't remember being on set. I don't remember any of these things. I am Chauncey Gardner, and people shouldn't be giving me the credit that I deserve. I'm a phantom, and I go into a room and I act, and then that phantom disappears and I go on being myself. That is Chauncey Gardner, and I relate to it wholeheartedly.
Interesting. Well, Jim Cummings, you've been wonderful. Is there anything you would like to tell people to watch, to look out for, to listen to? I'd say your next film if I was you.
You've done this before. No, man. Yeah, see The Beta Test. Nah. The Beta Test is out right
it's
now.
Really good.
It's quite fun. And I get to play an asshole talent agent and subvert the power dynamics of Hollywood.
Oh, also, I love how much you're shitting on agencies. I absolutely love it. I love it. I'm a huge fan of that.
Dude, I was so nervous. We got in so much trouble. So I got dropped by WME the week it came out, the day it came out, and I was very nervous. And I was like, oh no, did I do the wrong thing? Was I offensive? Was this terrible? Am I an asshole? I got sent to the principal's office. And the next day, Christopher Nolan's casting director reached out and was like, hey, Chris thought you'd be good for this part. I was like, cool. If nothing else ever happens to me, I've done something cool and my heroes like it. And that's all that matters.
Did you get done by your agency because of your films, like enough agencies?
The press that came out, they don't watch independent films. So it was the press that was surrounding it that was like, oh, Jim is making fun of agencies. And they said, you know what, we're going to leave you. We're going to be cheering from the sidelines, is what they said.
Wow. That's funny.
It happens. It's normal. I mean, yeah, you make something radioactive and then it becomes radioactive. I should have expected it. It happens.
Jim Cummings, you're a legend and an inspiration, and your films are very, very good. Thank you for doing the podcast. I hope you have a wonderful death and enjoy the rest of heaven.
I'm working on it.
Good day to you, sir.
Thank you so much, Brett. Good day. It was great talking to you.
It was lovely talking to you.
So that was episode 175. Head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 20 minutes of chat secrets and video with Jim Cummings. Go to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star rating, write about the film that means the most to you and why. It's lovely to read, helps numbers, blah, 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 blah. Thank you so much to Jim for doing this show. It was brilliant. Thank you for listening to it. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lytham for the photography. Come and join me next week for a brilliant episode with one of my favourite comedians, Mr. Rory Scoble. Oh, I hope you're all well. Thank you for listening. So that is it for now. In the meantime, have a lovely week and please be excellent to each other.
Sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.